So on behalf of myself and my colleagues, Judges Brown and Santel, I want to welcome you to this attorney admission ceremony. Before you appear before the court, I think it's important that you be familiar with the court's history. The court was formed by an act of Congress on February 9, 1893. Originally, it was called the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. The court then had one Chief Justice, as the position was then called, and two Associate Justices. It was not until 1948 that the court was given its present name. Since its founding, the court has grown from 3 to 12 authorized judgeships, and more recently decreased to 11. 57 judges have served on this court, including the 7 active and 6 senior judges who now sit. But what truly makes this circuit special are the members of the bar. The bar of the D.C. Circuit is made up of many highly regarded and skilled advocates, some of whom you will see today. Moreover, our bar members have a history of providing able pro bono assistance to those in need. The bar's pro bono service enables the court to do its work more effectively because we know the parties before the court are receiving good legal representation. I hope that all of you who will be sworn in today will consider participating in the court's pro bono program in the future. I know that all of you have worked very hard to get where you are today. You should take pride in your accomplishments. As you move forward in your careers, I hope you'll take a moment back to look back and thank those who have helped you get where you are. In the future, we hope you will help someone else just starting out in their career. I'm particularly pleased that several of our law clerks are being sworn in today. It's been a pleasure working with you over the past year. I know that today's performance is a lot less stressful than your preparation for oral argument. I eagerly await your return to this court as counsel. To all of you who are sworn in today, we look forward to your appearances before the court, and we know you will serve the cause of justice. All right, please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I state your name. Do solemnly swear that I will conduct myself as an attorney and counselor of this court, uprightly and according to the law, and that I will support the Constitution of the United States. Congratulations and welcome to the bar of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Mr. Scalia.
Good morning. May it please the court. Eugene Scalia representing appellants. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. In a series of recent unanimous decisions, this court has established the standards to be followed by the Securities and Exchange Commission when discharging its statutory responsibilities to consider costs and benefits when adopting rules. Three of those cases concerned the SEC's failure to give inadequate attention to the heightened regulatory protections available to mutual funds. And two of those cases involved the Commission's failure to establish a baseline, that is, to look at existing regulatory protections before claiming that its regulatory changes would result in new benefits. Before the court today is a different regulatory agency with statutory duties to consider costs and benefits, which are at least as great, and whose failings here are more extensive and go more to the heart of the rule and issue than in any of those prior cases. This court should vacate this rule, and its failure to do so would result in confusion in this court's existing precedents regarding financial regulations and cost-benefit analysis. This morning, I'd just like to address two things. First, liquidity, and second, some aspects of the cost-benefit analysis by the agency. With respect to liquidity, that is, investment activity in the markets, is always or virtually always an important consideration, an important aspect of the problem for an agency engaged in financial regulation. Liquidity brings more competition, efficiency, and therefore lower prices and more information on securities. And therefore, liquidity is always an important aspect of the problem. Here, it was an even more important consideration for the agency because it had been a primary purpose of the regulation that was being revisited and repealed. It had been raised by numerous commenters as an adverse consequence of the regulation at issue. And indeed, it had been central as well to the cost-benefit analysis by this very agency less than a decade before.
Can I ask you about those? So you're talking about the 2003 rule, right?
That's correct.
Do you know how many times the word liquidity was mentioned in that rule? In the entire explanation of its rationale for the rule?
At least twice, Your Honor.
Exactly twice. The word liquidity was mentioned twice in two sentences. And the extensive cost-benefit analysis that you're speaking of, which is half of a page, which is about slightly more than half of a page, three-quarters of a page, about one-tenth of the length of the cost-benefit analysis in this case, has one sentence about liquidity, just one sentence, and gives no reasoning, gives no quantitative analysis, none of the things you're asking for here. All it says is the amendments are expected to, that is a prediction, benefit efficiency and competition by removing barriers to participation in the commodity interest markets, resulting in greater liquidity and market efficiency.
Your Honor,
that's not any more extensive an explanation than the explanation in this case.
No, with respect, Your Honor, it's two more mentions than occur in the document release here. Liquidity was not mentioned, and although it was brief, it was a primary purpose of the rule being reversed, a primary purpose. It's as if in State Farm, safety had not been mentioned when the rule was reversed.
I can assure you the word safety in the State Farm airbag regulation was mentioned more than just two words, and there were extensive findings, including a cost-benefit analysis in the rule that the agency had discussed and a cost-benefit analysis that alternatives had been presented. There was none of that in the 2003 rule. All they said, they waved their hands and they said the word liquidity. That's it. Unless you know of an... Now, I'm not sure that there's not another place, but these are the only places I can
find. Aware of those two places. If there are more, I'll let you know. But again, a primary purpose of the regulation being reversed, and as well, Your Honor, it's axiomatic that when an agency imposes regulatory costs on an activity, that will disincentivize and discourage that activity. The indirect costs of a regulation are always an important thing to be considered. They were important in the Chamber 1 case. They were important in the Business Roundtable case. They're important in a range of cases this Court considers. This issue was raised by commenters as well, and in addition to being considered a primary purpose of the earlier rule. I am not here to defend the history of the CFTC's regulation. It's the first CFTC regulation before this Court, and I would suggest that agency will benefit from this Court making it clear, as it has to the SEC, what's expected in these circumstances. But this remained an important aspect of the problem that was utterly neglected. In terms of the cost-benefit itself, first, that was statutorily required. Second, again, liquidity, which was the purpose of the rule, which is an undeniable benefit of reduced regulation because you're reducing the costs on a particular economic activity, was wholly neglected. And the Commission repeatedly claimed, this is the third point, what it called two significant benefits, which it said justified this rule, and yet both of those benefits were things that were already supplied by SEC regulation. In fact, what's particularly striking about this rulemaking, Your Honor, is that there is even less discussion of the Comprehensive Investment Company Act regulatory regime here than occurred either in American Equity or in Business Roundtable, both unanimous decisions of this Court. So there is one third a column in the Federal Register. Chief Judge Garland, you've talked about how much quantity. A third of a column in the Federal Register plus a footnote given to the entire comprehensive ICA regulatory regime. By contrast, in the American Equity case, Six columns in the Federal Register were given to discussing features of state regulation in the area. Specific states were discussed. Specific state laws and regulations were discussed. Model code initiatives were discussed. There is no such discussion in the adopting release here. They don't mention an SEC rule. They don't mention an SEC requirement. They don't mention the requirements of the Investment Company Act. And they don't even mention the uniquely important role that independent directors play in constraining investment company conduct.
So they do have a section where they say that the SEC has noted that although its staff has addressed issues related to derivatives on a case-by-case basis, it has not developed a comprehensive, systematic approach to derivative issues, citing the SEC staff. And then it cited and adopted the view of the chairman of the SEC that the controls in place to address fund management and traditional securities can lose their effectiveness when applied to derivatives. This is particularly the case because a relatively small investment in a derivative instrument can expose a fund to potentially substantial gain or loss or outside exposure to an individual counterparty.
Your Honor, that was an agency examining its existing regulatory program, seeking comment on ways to improve it. That was not a conclusive determination. It was what it called a concept release. It was a draft. They asked, quote, whether, quote, now, there are improvements to be made.
So now you're not saying that they didn't address this. You're just saying that they shouldn't have relied on what the SEC and its chairman said. That's quite a different matter. And this is one to which we give considerably more deference.
I'm saying something a little bit different, Your Honor. I'm saying that when you are claiming benefits from new regulatory requirements, you need to examine the existing regulatory duties. They failed to do that. They took some quotes out of context in a draft document. I say draft because it was a concept release.
All right, so then you are challenging the reliability of what they relied on. That's a different matter than saying that they didn't consider the issue at all, which is what we were concerned with in the other cases. The other cases we were concerned, one case was about insurance annuities, and there was a statute that required them to take that into consideration, the state insurance annuities, and they didn't do it, the state regulation. Here, they actually did consider this.
Your Honor, what I'm saying is that a regulator's expression of the belief that it might do a better job, its examination of whether there are potentially problems, don't substitute for the agency undertaking to regulate itself to examine those things. But
this determination. They accepted the SEC's view that it wasn't doing a good job.
But, Your Honor, with all respect, that was not the SEC's view. Those were statements that they made in a concept release soliciting comment on whether changes can be made. They wholly failed to take account for the very same parallel regulatory structure, which is so importance in one part of the Business Roundtable case. But, Your Honor, additionally, there was a substantive error that resulted, which was that they claimed benefits that they could not. The two significant benefits they claimed, and they used that term twice, were benefits already supplied by SEC regulation. And I want to draw the panel's attention particularly to page A29 in the addendum to our brief. It's the middle column. It's Federal Register page 11280. And here's where we have what I call the hedge fund hedge. By the CFTC, because they claimed benefits from their rule that are clearly benefits supplied already by SEC regulation, namely audited financial statements, reporting to shareholders, books and records requirements, and the like. This is the middle column, and it has to do with fitness of mutual fund governance, which is one of the two significant benefits they claimed. Well, this directly establishes, Chief Judge Garland, that by failing to themselves consider the SEC regime, they proceeded to claim benefits they couldn't because the SEC already provides them. I've just mentioned what the benefits were, and the CFTC has said, well, we were talking about hedge funds there. We weren't talking about mutual funds.
Say the page again.
It's A29 in our brief, Your Honor. It's the middle column. The addendum. And they talk specifically about benefits supplied to the SECs, and the only response the CFTC has supplied, it's the hedge fund hedge. They said, oh, we were talking about hedge funds. That term does not appear here. There's no basis and reason to believe this was limited to hedge funds. And in fact, between the changes being made in this rule as between hedge funds and mutual fund companies received much more discussion in the adopting release. By my count, 8 pages in the adopting release are about mutual fund companies. Only 5 are about hedge funds and another related change that were made. So there's no basis and reason. It's just not true.
8 pages against 5 pages. Does that have some legal significance?
The significance is
he's focusing on the fact I mentioned 2 mentions of legal.
We're getting a little quantitative, unlike
the
agency.
Like a Da Vinci code at work or something.
Perhaps I prepared too hard. But my point, Your Honor, my point is...
For the new lawyers who just signed in, you can never prepare too hard.
They give no reason to believe this was just about hedge funds, and it couldn't have been, because this rule was about other things. And let me point something else out on the same page. If you look over to the column right next to it, the third column, they identify the benefits again. They say the benefits of this include that similarly situated entities will be subject to the, quote, same regulatory regime, end quote. Now, they're talking again about mutual funds. They'll be subject to the same regulatory regime. But the other thing the SEC did, in addition to claiming benefits it couldn't, it pushed off all cost assessment, or a substantial part of cost assessment, onto its so-called harmonization rule and said, oh, we're going to fix our rules so they're not so bad for mutual funds. But this benefit they're claiming is the benefit from the same regulation. They can't have it both ways. They can't say this is a good regulation because it's going to be the same, and then turn around and say, oh, we're not going to offend the costs imposed by our regulatory structure because we're going to change everything. In a sense, their position is, we decided to regulate these entities without even knowing what we would require of them, which is the essence of arbitrary and capricious. And by the way, the CFTC is telling you that they were going to consider the costs of this new regime when they did their harmonization rulemaking. But if you look in the appendix at page 476, where they do their statutory cost-benefit analysis of the harmonization rule, they don't own up to imposing new costs. They say they're reducing costs that were imposed by this rule. So again, the essence of arbitrary and capricious
rulemaking. Take nothing from the fact that the statute gives the commission exclusive jurisdiction over some of these things.
With respect to these particular entities, again, this SEC already has regulation.
Not the entities, but exclusive jurisdiction with respect to these kinds of instruments. And then we have a case in which, for example, we said FERC, which we just came out with, you're very familiar with, in which we said FERC can't regulate market manipulation in a certain area because it's exclusively given to
the CFTC. And the CFTC can regulate market manipulation even if you're not registered. With respect to the SEC's regulation, the SEC regulates these entities comprehensively. So it doesn't just regulate.
Are you saying that the registration makes no difference then in how
with respect to manipulation, it does not.
Pardon?
With respect to manipulation, it does not.
Why is it a burden if it's not... Why is it a burden to be registered?
Well, the burdens are the same as in the American Equity case. It's on page 826, the commission identifies hundreds of thousands of dollars annually for each fund as an estimated cost, being inspected every 2 to 3 years by the National Futures Association, having two new regulatory masters. These are all significant costs, plus the added cost of this compliance regime, which they call purely hypothetical.
We don't know what the cost of the compliance will be yet. Is that fair? We don't know what that is. If those costs turn out to be very high, you can object to if they're not harmonized with the SEC rules, then you can object at that point.
But to the extent we don't know the costs, we don't know the benefits. Again, they're trying to have it both ways.
Well, they're
saying
they're getting regulatory
benefits.
They're getting benefits from registration, from information requirements, from the ability to punish somebody if it becomes necessary to do that. The additional things that we're talking about are things that will happen or not happen, depending on whether you succeed in challenging those rules or not.
And those abilities were ones that the SEC already had. Well, if I could reserve the remainder of my time for...
Let me just ask one more question. They said that you didn't put in any information about the costs associated, quantitative information about the costs associated with registration. Is that right?
That's incorrect. At page 826, they cite information submitted by a commenter and about the annual cost, which I gave you, $150 to $250.
And that's the one they cite. So you're not saying that they didn't find any additional costs that you knew about or anything like that?
Strict quantitative costs, no. But a range of different costly things, yes.
And the size of the companies that we're talking about here, the high range is $1.5 billion in assets. Is that right? The next range is $150 million in assets?
I haven't gone back and checked those particular numbers, but I believe that's correct. But each burden that's placed on these companies ends up being burdens and costs placed on their shareholders. And again, it's undisputed, and they give no reason to believe that increasing the cost of activity in this area won't decrease activity in the area. That's axiomatic, not just for financial regulation, but for regulation generally.
Well, they have benefits on the other side, which they're concerned about, and which the statute gives them the authority to be concerned about.
Page 48 of their brief, they refer to their so-called compliance rules as purely hypothetical, and yet they repeatedly claim benefits from them on the hedge fund hedge on page 829 of our addendum.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Hear from the CFTC.
Good morning. May it please the court. Jonathan Marcus for the CFTC. The district court correctly upheld the CFTC's rule requiring registered investment companies that trade a significant amount of commodity interests to register under the Commodity Exchange Act and report financial data. As the district court concluded, the rule is a prudent and modest measure to restore oversight in the wake of the financial crisis and the legislative response in Dodd-Frank. Because the CFTC's action here clearly satisfies the APA's deferential standard of review, plaintiffs have attempted to subject the commission to a more exacting standard. The district court correctly rejected.
What do you say about the liquidity argument?
Your Honor, that's their main assertion on appeal, and the claim is meritless. The agency did address liquidity. It directly addressed commenters' concerns that conflicting CFTC and SEC compliance obligations would deter trading activity. The commission responded to those concerns, and it's on page A288 and 305 of the appendix where the CFC directly addresses the
reference again, please.
I'm sorry, yeah, A288 and A305, two pages in the rule release where the commission addressed the commenters' concern that these conflicting obligations would deter trading activity. And the commission responded to those concerns by excising the compliance obligations from the final rule and subjecting them to a reproposal whose goal is to harmonize the two regimes. So the agency directly addressed...
Talk about the liquidity just a minute first, though. You're talking now about the harmonization. What in the response do you that, speak that, to the liquidity?
That harmonization, that was a response to the concerns raised in the comments that the conflicting compliance obligations would deter trading activity, that entities wouldn't be able to comply with both, and that would then deter them from trading in the CFTC's markets.
That's the closest you get to liquidity?
I'm sorry?
That's the closest you get to liquidity? Not the rules per se.
Well, there are other things the agency said here, Your Honor. The agency might not in the final rule have invoked the magic words liquidity, but it did.
That is a good way to deal with liquidity is to invoke the magic word, counsel.
But
I'm not sure what's magic about it, but it's the word we're talking about. So speaking it is a good way to invoke it.
But Your Honor, what the commission said was because there's no data about their trading activity in our markets, the rule actually give the commission the ability to determine the role that large CPOs do play in providing liquidity in the markets. And the commission also talked about its concerns that if you don't have oversight of high levels of trading activity, that can create systemic risks. And that's another way in which the agency addressed liquidity. During the financial crisis, what that taught us is when you have a rapid and dramatic change in values of positions, even if you had high levels of trading activity, the market can seize up, and all of a sudden, their traders are in positions where they can't exit their positions and they can't cover their positions. So what the agency was saying here was that a better approach to risk management going forward and to protecting against systemic risk was to have a level of oversight.
Would it be fair to say that your position is that without using the word liquidity, the policy change is analyzed just in different terms with reference to the balance between market risk and deterrence of trading, if it were?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's correct. They point out in their reply brief, they say there are a couple commenters who claim that registration alone would deter trading activity, and that's not the case around these.
I tried to ask your opposing counsel about that, but I guess I didn't use the magic words to get that back out either. Excuse me, go ahead.
But these comment letters were in response to a proposal that included restoring the entire Part 4 regime, all the compliance obligations. And what the commenters said in those letters was that if the costs of the regulatory regime were prohibitive, that might deter trading activity. Plaintiffs here in this case don't allege that the costs of registration are prohibitive. In fact, in their comment letter, they proposed registration without having to comply with the Part 4 obligations. So that there's no basis to conclude on this record that there's going to be any deterrence of trading activity. And in addition, Your Honor, there was no data provided to the Commission on this issue of liquidity, that at what cost, that if the cost got to a certain point, that entities would be deterred from trading in our markets. No data was provided, and the Commission had no obligation to conduct an independent study on that. Finally, because the Commission had no obligation, because it didn't have no reason to believe there wouldn't be any effect on liquidity in this rulemaking, and no data to support that belief, the Commission had no obligation to identify it as a cost in the cost-benefit analysis. The plaintiffs in their reply brief convey the misleading impression that the Commission has somehow said that liquidity is always a factor to be considered in the cost-benefit analysis. They cite a 1998 release that was 2 years before the Commission even had a cost-benefit consideration requirement under Section 15. That didn't come in until 2000. What the Commission in 1998 was addressing was a rule involving position limits, and where with position limits, which impose actual restrictions on trading, it stands to reason that liquidity would be a concern, something that the Commission would address when discussing whether to impose or take away position limits.
Can you ever deal with cost-benefit in a market-regulating commission without at least considering liquidity? Isn't that rather fundamental to what you're doing there, or am I wrong?
Well, I think it depends. I mean, I think it depends on what the rule is doing, Your Honor. And as I said before, the Commission here did address liquidity in multiple ways, again, by breaking off the compliance obligations that were identified as something that might deter trading activity, and here explaining why that ultimately that we would have healthier markets if there was some level of oversight over trading activity.
Do you agree that the Commission has a responsibility to do a cost-benefit analysis, or did I misunderstand you?
Well, the Commission under Section 15A has an obligation to consider the costs and benefits.
But that could be different than what we would normally think of as a cost-benefit analysis. So what I'm trying to...
Right. I don't think it's the same thing, Your Honor. I think that, I mean, and this Court and the National Association of Home Builders case has said when in a case where an agency has an obligation to consider costs, that doesn't mean that the agency has to conduct a full-blown cost-benefit analysis. It has to consider the costs of what it's doing, which means to think carefully about them, to discuss them, and that's what the Commission did here, Your Honor. The Commission went through in the cost-benefit analysis. It identified the certain costs of registration, the $750 annual membership fee with the NFA, a $200 application fee, and it also and it went through and also identified the amount of time it would take to fill out the forms for form CPO PQR. It also went through and took a lot of steps to reduce burdens by reducing the frequency of the reporting, by increasing in the final rule the threshold so that only entities that have over $1.5 billion in assets have to do the most detailed form, the Schedule C on form CPO PQR. And so all those measures that the Commission took to reduce burdens shows that the Commission considered the costs and benefits. It also went through the five factors that it has to consider that sort of channels the agency's discretion when it's considering the costs and benefits of its rules. And it went through all five of those factors, as the District Court explained. Now, plaintiffs have raised raised the argument that there was one benefit that the Commission claimed here that comes from compliance obligations, and Your Honor, that is not correct. And if you look at, let me just say, this is something that they first argued in the rebuttal before the District Court at the oral hearing. So this is not something they take us to task for not making this explanation before, but we didn't have an opportunity to make this explanation in the District Court. But the statement to which they refer must be read in the context of the entire document and everything that came before it. This rulemaking not only eliminated the blanket exclusion for registered investment companies in Rule 4.5, but it rescinded the exemption for hedge funds in 4.13A4. And the rule explains very clearly the changes that it's making to both. The rule release also makes very clear in several places that with respect to mutual funds, registered investment companies, the compliance obligations will be addressed in a separate harmonization rulemaking. By contrast, when it talks about Rule 4.13A4 in several places, it talks about the compliance obligations that are going to be imposed on private funds. And so if you read the entire document, when you get to the end in the discussion of the 15A factors, and there's a reference to the account statements and disclosure documents, that is, in context, it's a reference to something that's an obligation that's being imposed on hedge funds and not being imposed on the registered investment companies.
Back to 19A, is the commission, in fact, claiming benefits from those things that are not determined until the compliance rules, while ignoring costs?
Not at all, Your Honor. The commission claimed as benefits for the changes to 4.5 were two main things. One, ensuring competence to trade in the commission's markets, and two, to help the commission enforce the CEA, to provide a more effective means of enforcing the Commodity Exchange Act. It makes a big difference to have entities registered with the commission. It knows the identity of the players in its markets. It can access books and records by statute. And so it makes a big difference. Now, plaintiffs make light of these two benefits, but these are significant benefits. Registration is the foundation for conducting oversight. We have in the record A832 through about A840. We have letters from the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations that talk about the tremendous amount of money that's being invested by registered investment companies in the commodity markets without CFTC oversight. Well, there's a reference to one fund that has over $22 billion invested in commodity interests.
What do you say to the proposition advanced by the appellants that you are claiming benefits that already are there from SEC regulation? You're failing to recognize regulatory overlap.
Not at all, Your Honor. That claim, first of all, disregards the statutory scheme that Congress established. Congress established the CFTC and the SEC to pursue different responsibilities. It gave the CFTC the responsibility to regulate the futures market and the swaps market. And the Commission has specific obligations under Section 3 of the CEA to avoid systemic risk in those markets, to protect the financial integrity of transactions in those markets. The SEC does not have those purposes. So when the Commission is saying in this rule that through registration it's going to ensure the competence to trade in its markets and it's going to help enforce the Commodity Exchange Act, those are things that will help the CFTC pursue and accomplish its mission under the CEA. Those are not objectives that the SEC pursues.
One more point on the multiplicity of regulators. There seems to be a hit and then sort of a back off by the appellants to the effect that there are inconsistencies in which the regulated entity could not comply with SEC without violating CFTC. Is that true in the final version after the comments, or?
No, that's what why we've spun off the compliance obligations through harmonization to avoid a situation where they complying with one would mean they'd be out of compliance with the other.
The compliance regulations result in a different analysis of cost benefit or do not result in it either way, do you see any reason why appellants would be precluded from at that time bringing a new proceeding to court to reevaluate?
They'll be free to challenge the result of the harmonization rulemaking, whatever compliance obligations are imposed. I would point out that if there's a particular disclosure obligation that the CFTC is requiring that the SEC doesn't, let's say, I don't know, 30 pages of disclosure of the risks of swaps, they'll be free to challenge that. But I think,
cost-benefit analysis.
Yes, and if they establish that that's...
Will there be a new cost-benefit analysis?
Yes, there will be a new cost-benefit analysis, but they'd be free to challenge that. But I think the remedy for that, Your Honor, would be either to modify that compliance obligation or strike it, but it wouldn't be to strike registration, invalidate the registration, which serves fundamentally broader and purposes.
What about maybe this is the same question. What about opposing counsel's argument that the SEC regime already requires auditing financial statements, books and records?
Yeah, the audited financial statements and that reference again to the disclosure documents, account statements, audited financial state. That reference again, the commission was not referring to registered investment companies when it made that reference. If you look at the harmonization rulemaking, those things are specific. The harmonization rulemaking, the rule release. in, I think it's A472 in the appendix, that that's the commission there discusses those very requirements with respect to registered investment companies and as a way, a means of trying to harmonize the two regimes. So
but
the commission is doing
He says you're drawing benefits from those. You're counting those as benefits.
Right, and we're not counting those for benefits in this rulemaking. The commission, that statement again was a reference to the changes to the rules for hedge funds, which are subject to the Part IV regime, the full Part IV regime. But the commission has separated out those issues, disclosure documents, account statements, and is dealing with that in the harmonization rulemaking. If you look at that rule release, you'll see a discussion of those there. The commission here for registered investment companies was relying on the benefits, the two benefits that are stated throughout the rule release, ensuring competence to trade in our markets, making sure that people are trading in our markets, and they take the Series 3 exam. They learn about futures trading and hedging and so on, all the requirements, the familiarity with the CFTC rules, and better ability to enforce the CEA. Those are the benefits that are claimed throughout the rule release, and then also, of course, the separate benefits of the information collection, which helps protect against systemic risk.
Why wasn't the 2000 rule good enough? Did anything change between 2003 and the time that you announced this rule?
A lot changed, Your Honor, and the commission repeatedly referred to the economic turmoil and the financial crisis. It also referred repeatedly to the changes in the Dodd-Frank law, which rescinded large parts of the Commodity Futures Modernization
Act. What does
the
financial crisis have to do with this? Supposing counsel's briefs says that mutual funds, et cetera, weren't responsible for the crisis.
Right, and I think that misses the point, Your Honor. The commission can act prophylactically to protect against risks that could develop in the future. And the commission has made the conclusion based on the level of trading that's going on in its markets, that came to the attention of the commission through the National Futures Association and also through the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. The high level of trading without any oversight can create significant...
A level of trading in what?
In derivatives, Your Honor, can create significant risks, and it's similar to the risks posed by private funds that are investing in our markets. And Congress we quoted a Senate committee report which states that even though hedge funds are not thought to have caused the financial crisis, it's critical to get information about their strategies, about their positions going forward to help head off and address the next possible crisis. And it's the same logic that applies to restoring oversight of these registered investment companies, only those that are trading substantially in our markets. And that was the purpose for this rule, and that's how it's related to the financial crisis.
Questions? Okay, does Mr. Scalia have any time left? We'll give you 2 minutes. I'm sure I ate up some of your time.
Judge Sentelle, you asked whether the commission had claimed any benefits from features of its compliance rules. You were told no. The fact is yes. A29, the addendum to our brief, column 3, the commission said, quote, because similarly situated entities in the derivatives market will be subject to the same regulatory regime, the competitiveness of market participants will be enhanced. That consideration of competition was one of the essential things they were requiring to do. They relied on their so-called compliance rules, which at page 48 of their brief, when addressing costs, they called hypothetical. They're trying to have it both ways. They also claimed benefits from the so-called compliance rules at the part I've identified to you, the hedge fund hedge. All I can tell you is that the claim that applies only to hedge funds was made for the first time in this court. The district court understood it to apply to mutual funds. In fact, it quoted it as one of the benefits of the rule. And it was only in this court that the lawyers for the agency made that claim.
This is a dispute about whether they meant investment banks or investment companies.
That's separate, Your Honor. Here, they're saying that this is talking about hedge funds. There's nothing in the face of the text, no reason to believe it's true. You also were told that none of these requirements that are imposed by the CFTC's rules and which are also imposed by the SEC will actually be imposed in harmonization. Well, in fact, some of them will. It's not true that the books and records requirements...
Can you bring that back up at that time?
Well, and what you heard was no, because this is a fundamentally... What you heard, Your Honor, is we're going to regulate these people because of benefits that we can't even yet determine. based on costs that we refuse to consider.
I understand that is a difficulty. What I'm asking you now is, can you re-raise that difficulty?
Council was very careful to say that we will never be able to challenge the registration decision, in their view, once this case is over, even if the harmonization rule confirms that the registration decision itself was mistaken. What you have is an agency that decided to regulate literally without knowing what regulations it would apply. That was fundamentally arbitrary and capricious, and if this court permits this decision to stand, it will sharply undercut.
Well, they know some of the they know it's going to be there's going to be registration. They know there's going to be reporting requirements, right? You know those things.
But when they claimed in the third column of A29 that it would be the same regime, that's not true, and they don't know what the content's going to be. And that's, in fact, part of their defense, that they didn't know what they were going to do. Again, to affirm this would be to sharply undermine four unanimous decisions of this court and send exactly the wrong message to the CFTC.
Aren't dealing with a different, as Judge Rudge, and excuse me, Judge Brown suggested, aren't those four dealing with a different cost-benefit analysis requirement than the one here?
The cost-benefit requirement on the CFTC is more specific, and I would submit more exacting than the one on the SEC. So it can't be distinguished on that ground.
This says consider cost-benefit.
And this says evaluate as well as consider.
Well, now, it says it shall consider it, and then it says to evaluate in light of three, four, five factors instead of just the one. Five factors, including one of which is the one, two, three, four factors that was in the other one. So now we've got like 10 factors they have to consider.
More factors than the SEC has. You can't distinguish those cases on that ground is what it boils down to.
Well, but since there are so many, it makes it a little hard to make a really fine cost-benefit analysis if there are a large number of factors, many of which are quite subjective. Any other public interest consideration, for example.
But can it, at minimum, for example, require that the word liquidity be mentioned, that the issue be addressed, which it wasn't, and the sites that you were given, they weren't cited in their brief. I've looked at them briefly. I don't see it addressing liquidity at all. One final point, Your Honor, which is that the notion that a regulator can refer to another regulator's expressions of question whether there are better ways to regulate in the area, that alone can be enough to cast aside an entire regulatory regime within the requirements laid down by this court in American Equity and in Business Roundtable. That also would eviscerate those decisions.
Fox, the court said all that's necessary is the agency believes it's better. Not even that it is better. Just all that's necessary is the agency believes it's better than what they had previously said.
Well, it said that in the context of also saying there wasn't a heightened standard. We're not arguing for a heightened standard. We're saying that an important aspect of the problem has to be considered, which includes what you've got a statutory cost-benefit obligation, and you're regulating the financial sector. You need to address whether you're going to decrease investment activity when less than a decade before you did something in order to increase it. They failed to do that and permit them to use an SEC, quote, concept release, which solicited comment, did not reflect a final determination, to permit them to substitute that for a genuine evaluation of existing regulations would topple the Business Roundtable in American Equity cases and the baseline requirement established there.
Okay, thank you. We'll take the matter under consideration. We appreciate the arguments of counsel.